KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
They've manipulated their currency to try and give them an unfair advantage when it comes to selling their product overseas.
Perhaps we should also consider acts of terrorism as grounds for deemed renunciation if committed by dual citizens who carry Canadian nationality.
I've narrowed your choices down to five unthinkable options. Each will cause untold misery.
I pick number 3.
You don't even want to read them first?
I was elected to lead, not to read.
There's a fictional president for you from The Simpsons. We're going to talk about following the president's State of the Union. Who were the great fictional presidents portrayed on film and in television? Also, the real presidents portrayed by actors. Maybe you have some thoughts. So we're gonna poll you, take some calls, and play some clips when Robert Horton joins us. We also heard from Matt Blunt, the former governor of Missouri, on the global effect of cheapening the Japanese yen. We'll talk about the economy. That's coming up with Michael Parks. But we start, you heard there from Stephen Kenney. He's the Canadian Minister for Citizenship and Immigration, on dual citizens allegedly involved in Bulgarian terrorist attacks, also in Algeria, Canadians who hold other passports. It's become a big issue in Canada. Vaughn Palmer is political correspondent for the Vancouver Sun. He joins us on weekday. Hello, Vaughn.
Hi, Steve.
You said this could have a negative impact on cross-border relations here in North America. Canadian passports under a cloud.
Yeah, I think it already has had a negative impact. This is very, very embarrassing for Canada, and our government is still partly in denial about how bad a problem it is. What you've had is a juxtaposition of events that's made it worse. We talked about this a while ago, that terrible terrorist attack in Algeria that left so many people dead. The Algeria government has stated flatly that two Canadians were involved, one of them the ringleader, and these are identified as Canadians because they have Canadian passports. And the Canadian government says it's still waiting for the evidence on that, but I think that one, I've seen that one reported all over the world. I think most other places have accepted that one of the ringleaders was a Canadian. And at the same time, a guy with a Canadian passport, again, and a man with an Australian passport, have now been linked by the Bulgarian government to that fatal attack where the busload of Israeli tourists was blown up. With DNA evidence, they've identified the Canadian. So in both cases, you've got a link to Canada. We need to explain a couple of things on that, and that is you heard the comments from the minister about dual citizenship. With the bombing in Bulgaria, the man who entered Bulgaria on the Canadian passport had left Canada at the age of 8 and gone back to Lebanon, where his family lived. So he was recruited to terrorist activity there, not in Canada, when he was 8 years old. The widespread speculation is the reason terrorist organizations seek out people with dual citizenship, Canadian passports, is because it's a lot easier for them to get into the target country. They've got an actual legitimate document. They use the legitimate passport to get into the country that they're headed for. They then go undercover and go underground. So the passport is their entry point, and people with two passports, of course, dual citizenship, it's a lot easier to get them in.
What changes can the Canadian government make?
Well, they've got a big problem because we have 60,000 people who live in Lebanon. Some of them have been there for years, and they still have a Canadian passport. We have allowed this to go on for a long time. So that's a fairly large pool of people living in the Middle East who, if a terrorist organization wished to recruit from them, there's an awful lot of people there. You may recall that the last war involving Lebanon, the Canadian government evacuated all of its citizens. We ended up evacuating something like 40 or 50,000 people at government cost. So this is a big. And how do you stop it? Well, abolish dual citizenship is the extreme measure. The government's talking about revoking the citizenship of people that are involved in terrorist acts, which is after the fact. I mean, the guy in Bulgaria was blown up. So whether we revoke his citizenship at this point is kind of beside the point.
So this is now, he used a word, I forget what that word he used was, but this is now a point of discussion.
Yeah.
But they're not, they don't really have much wiggle room, it seems.
They don't know what to do about it because the problem is so widespread. And their great concern is that what this means is foreign countries will pay an awful lot closer attention to people with Canadian passports because of a growing suspicion that they are the passport of choice for international terrorism.
Wow.
Needless to say, the government is not very happy with that kind of talk going on, Steve. But, you know, I mean, other countries have to think about their own security, and you can say what you like about targeting and profiling, but it's understandable if our country's passport has been involved in two major terrorist events. I mean, an awful lot of people were killed in both these attacks. Our passport is involved in both of them, and the government is kind of in despair and can't even figure out what the heck to do about it except to take the passport away from someone who's dead. You can't entirely blame other countries for putting Canadian passports on a watch list.
You know, I don't know if you know this. If you don't, maybe our listeners do. If somebody shows a Canadian passport, for example, does it also register to the authorities that they are they hold passports from other countries?
That's a very good question, and I don't know the answer. I doubt it.
Hmm. Yeah, I do too.
I doubt it. But they might. And it might be a question that people get asked at the border, depending on their country of origin.
Yeah.
So again, you'll have the allegation that someone's being profiled, right? I mean, imagine if you were a Canadian born in Lebanon. There are many of them, right? And you're innocently entering the United States, and somebody looks at your passport and goes, well, all Canadian passports from people born in Lebanon are now on a watch list, right? Well, that's not fair, and I can imagine those people might have a really bad day, but on the other hand, that's how watch lists are made up.
Yeah. Vaughn Palmer's our guest. All right, Vaughn, this I found fascinating. Canadians, on average, pay higher prices than Americans. A Canadian Senate committee took a look. They came up with a bunch of answers. What are they?
Well, yeah, the Canadian Senate, there have been a lot of complaints about this problem, Steve, since the dollar, the Canadian dollar and the American dollar are close to par. I mean, they bounce up and down, but it's close to par. And Canadians, of course, are heavily involved in cross-border shopping and bargain hunting south of the border. Why? And there's a lot of examples. I mean, everything from the price of hardcover books to automobiles, you know, simple stuff like I see ketchup's on the list and orange juice, 26% difference in the price of orange juice. Like, so the Canadian government Senate struck a committee, or is a committee itself, and studied this thing. They came up with general explanations. The Canadian government still has a lot of tariffs. In spite of free trade, we put tariffs on a lot of things, and they said the government really should review the tariff schedule. They pointed to taxes as a factor. There are some areas where taxes are a factor, although they tried to, you know, extract those so that you're not comparing places that have different sales tax rates. The other thing they talked about is a lack of competition. I mean, that's a big problem, is that America has absolutely ruthless take-no-prisoners competition, and Canadian retailers just don't face that much competition, so they get away with less competitive pricing.
Now, I always thought that in Canada the argument was we have to have protections for our local industries. Is that what is in part responsible for higher costs?
That's the residue of protection here, although, as the Senate committee pointed out, some of the industries we are protecting, in fact, no longer exist. Or the companies are owned by Americans. So the rationale for protection in some areas. And one of the examples they gave was T-shirts. Most of the Canadian T-shirt manufacturers have gone out of business, even though most of the T-shirts had a tariff to protect them. So that's one that doesn't make an awful lot of sense. The Canadian government slaps a 10% import tax on books, which is why you get Steve Jobs' book. This is one of the examples from the list, the hardcover Steve Jobs book. $16.85 U.S. Amazon, $23.19 Canada Amazon. Now, you know, prices bounce around all the time. These are snapshot examples that the committee used to illustrate its concerns. But, you know, the Canadians who go across the border to shop aren't living in fantasy land. They're bargaining hunting, and they're finding them. And so taxes are part of the story, tariffs are part of the story, lack of competition part of the story. Remedies, that's a little tougher. You know, the Canadian, they also say the Canadian market is smaller but spread out, so sure, that the economies of scale that are available in the United States are not available here. You're dragging a smaller amount of goods over a much bigger country, and as a result, Americans are able to offer better bargains, American retailers, because they're simply more efficient, because the country's retail market is more efficiently organized.
I thought NAFTA was going to solve these issues.
The North American Free Trade Agreement. It's amazing, though, reading over the list of, there are still hundreds of tariffs on goods. In spite of free trade, in spite of the auto pact, for example, I mean, this one fascinates me. We've got an auto pact, cars that are made in the United States, cars that are made in Canada. They're part of a giant free trade agreement that goes back 40 years, nearly 50 years. And yet this Senate committee documented vast differences in automobiles between the two countries in prices. Chevy Equinox, here's one, $26,445 U.S. That's backwards. That's the Canadian price, $23,530 Canadian. There's a whole bunch of examples from the list. Now, you may remember we talked about this years ago, because we've been talking about stuff for years, Steve, back when the Canadian dollar was low, really low, there were bargains in Canada because of the auto pact. So the structure, the pricing structure was different because the Canadian dollar was so low. So you had Americans coming up here taking advantage of their very, very valuable dollar to buy goods at Canadian prices. A big chunk of this was masked for years because the dollar was so low. The Canadian dollar hit 60 cents U.S. at one point. Now that, you know, as I say, they bounce around at par or a little bit above, a little bit below, all of these sort of things that the retailers can't hide anymore are now on parade in this Senate report.
Very interesting. All right, Vaughn, this is fascinating to me on a level that's not just necessarily about what you were talking about. So there are all sorts of economic questions here, but Prime Minister Stephen Harper's upcoming book on the history of professional hockey. I just want to know where the man found time to write a book about professional hockey.
Yes, he did. He wrote a book about professional hockey. His office huffily informed one of our newspapers this week. One of our newspapers reported that the thing was ghostwritten, and the Prime Minister's office said it is not ghostwritten. The Prime Minister wrote the book himself. Somebody was hired to edit it, but everybody has editors. Stephen Harper's a huge hockey fan, and I guess he's sitting around there at home in the evening with his pet chinchilla, Charlie, and his pet cat, Stanley, and he's rattling away a book on hockey. This is hilarious. He's sold the book to an American publisher, Simon & Schuster, which can't actually print the book in Canada because of our tariff rules. So the book will be printed in the United States and distributed in Canada. It'll be available to Americans, too, if they want to read the Prime Minister's book on hockey. And by the way, the money is being given to a very good cause, Military Families Fund of the Canadian Forces Personnel and Family Support Services. So Stephen Harper is donating his royalties to military families.
And there'll be that tariff, that premium, because it was printed in the U.S.
Yeah.
All right, Vaughn, good to talk to you again.
Talk to you next week. next week.
Take care. Vaughn Palmer is political. Bye-bye. Vaughn Palmer is political correspondent. I always have to wait for that. Vaughn Palmer is political correspondent with the Vancouver Sun. He is also often on Canadian radio as well. This is Weekday.
KUOW, it's 10:19.
This was the message last year.
Together we offered a final proud salute to the colors under which more than a million of our fellow citizens fought.
The president may have a similar message this year for soldiers serving in Afghanistan, the State of the Union, Obama's second term. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 1 o'clock on KUOW, 47 and overcast in the University District. It's going to be cloudy today with a chance of rain. We'll have a high around 50 degrees. It's going to be cloudy with rain possible tonight. Expect a low of 46 and count on some rain tomorrow morning. It'll be cloudy during the afternoon tomorrow. Maybe see some rain then as well. We'll have a high of about 48. I'm Rob Wood. Good morning. In the news, the International Olympic Committee announced wrestling may not be included in the 2020 Olympics, and Seattle's bike share plan is kicking into high gear. Ross Reynolds brings you all the details on the conversation later in the noon hour, only here on KUOW.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat. The sparkling.
We're going to get the dots out, talk about film with Robert Horton. Some, you know, we talk about many things with Robert Horton, but today we're talking about film and TV in particular and performances because of the State of the Union. The president had a fine performance, I thought, last night in his State of the Union. What'd you think, Robert Horton?
Pretty darn good. Pretty darn good.
You know, he has a new speechwriter that helps him with his work.
Yeah.
And young man, 32-year-old man. It had a whole different cadence, I thought. A whole different, you know, let's get it done sort of short sentences. I thought he was maybe like a film president. Let's get it done. Let's get it done.
Well, maybe like a film actor, he's grown into the role.
Oh.
Sometimes if you're on a weekly series, you really start to get into it after you've gotten the bugs out a little bit.
It is a role.
It certainly is.
It is a role. So, all right. So there's the president's the standard right now. Let's take the last, you know, we got a lot of presidents as the standard for, you know, portraying the role of president.
Yes.
I think they're actually doing it, of course, but I don't know where the line is drawn. And then you started thinking about other people who have, as actors, have taken on the role.
Well, we got a lot of presidents in movies.
Yeah,
and
we got
TV.
A lot.
Yeah.
Well, we have an Academy Award nominated president, actor, Daniel Day-Lewis, right, in Lincoln?
We certainly do.
He's going to win.
And he's probably, yes, he's probably going to win.
Because, you know, he's Lincoln. Who was the best, who are the other Lincolns?
Well, there have been so many of them, but
Henry Fonda played Lincoln.
That he certainly did, yes.
Young Abe Lincoln.
Young Mr. Lincoln. Yeah. Raymond Massey played Lincoln a couple of times.
Really?
Yeah. I can't think of the actor's name, but obviously someone played him in Abe Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
Well, that was probably stellar. Stellar portrayal of Abe Lincoln.
But it's going to be hard for anybody to fill Daniel Day-Lewis's shoes after this, actually, because it's kind of an amazing performance. And perhaps almost like a scientist putting together the pieces of what we know about Lincoln and reconstituting him, you know, the voice and the movements and everything.
I have yet to see that. I'm sorry. Wasn't he kind of breathy in that? I can't remember. High-pitched, breathy?
As he does, he has developed a particular speaking style, and it is, you know, based on what people have wrote about Lincoln and a certain Kentucky by way of Illinois sound, and it's pretty uncanny. It'll be hard to wipe that away now that it's there.
And Sally Field, of course, too. She now owns the role of
Mary Todd
Lincoln.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that we are at this point thinking about presidents as performers, and we have this sort of interesting film. I mean, this film is many accolades, right? Lots of support. People like it a lot.
Yeah, and
it's going to win a lot of awards.
And has it's admitted to have been conceived as a kind of comment, reflection, echo, whatever, of our political situation now.
Yeah.
So it lives. It really is alive.
Robert Horton reviews films for the Herald and Everett. He also writes about films at The Crop Duster, his blog, and he hosts The Magic Lantern, a monthly series of discussions on cinema at the Fry Art Museum. But the most important thing he does is come here every Wednesday and talk to us.
I'll say.
Yeah, that's what it's all about.
Thank you.
All right, so we asked people for their nominations for best presidents. We're going to play a couple of clips, but first I want to read a couple of emails because people have their opinions. Hands down, Henry Fonda in Failsafe. Tense and touching rendition of a plain-spoken commander-in-chief facing the toughest 3 a.m. call imaginable. That's from Tom in Bothell. Yeah, he had to decide whether he was going to not just let the New York City be blown up, but send his friend to get blown up. Well, that wasn't really – I shouldn't give it away.
Well,
I just spoiled
okay.
it there.
No, it's that's
going into Moscow.
That was on my list of favorite presidents, too.
Yeah, Henry Fonda was a good president. Yeah. Gives a lot of
– Failsafe is certainly one – one believes that Henry Fonda could occupy the office pretty well.
Oh, yeah. Martin Sheen is Jeb Bartlett, hands down, Leah says.
Jed.
Yeah. Jed.
That's going to be that's going to be a popular one, no question about it. And that was the West Wing, which is what we're talking about. And, you know, I don't know what year the West Wing began.
Well, I'll be happy to tell you.
And if you could file that up. But it certainly, at the time, seemed to be... playing out things that one wished were playing out in reality. There was a strong, strong wish fulfillment to that presidency.
September 22nd, 1999.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were – right. Sorkin was sort of, this is what I would do if I could recreate Bill Clinton. And then, of course, it changed even more when George Bush became president. It was pointedly sort of opposed to – plot lines were opposed to what George Bush was doing in public.
In particular, particularly opposed to kind of mindset of maybe going away from a rational political discourse toward one more based in fear and superstition, things like that. That show was awfully good at channeling that.
Yeah, yeah.
And for that 1 hour a week, you actually had something to feel good about.
depending on your politics.
I guess so.
Yeah. 206-543-5869 is our number. We're wondering if you might have some presidential picks. 1-800-289-5869. Who made the best president, film and television? I don't know. I guess it sort of tells us what we want in a television based what we want in a president based on our picks. Another person Gordon writing, serious consideration to Henry Fonda in Failsafe. And you will appreciate this, Peter Sellers in Dr. Strangelove.
Yes.
Boy, we have Peter Sellers president twice, don't we?
What's the other one?
Chauncey Gardner.
Well, he's an important figure, and he's not president.
Oh, what was he? I thought he was president.
He's a special advisor to the president, isn't he?
I forget now. You're right. He must be special. He never was president in that movie?
No.
Being there?
So, no.
Huh.
Yeah, certainly on my list was Peter Sellers as President Merkin Muffley in Dr. Strangelove, one of the three roles that he played in that. And he's probably the most ineffectual fictional president, I suppose, that we've seen. Classic sort of appeaser type who kind of allows nuclear war to be happening anyway.
I was trying to remember why he was so weak-kneed in that. What was it about that he was so weak-kneed?
Well, he was kind of a portrait of just a moderate politico of the Cold War era, I guess, civilized and all that.
He was a little Adlai Stevenson, wasn't he?
He did have a bald head, and there may have been an exaggerated allusion to Adlai Stevenson or something like that.
By the way, you are, of course, always right, and I am always wrong. Jack Warden was the president in Being There.
Okay.
Jack Warden would be an interesting choice for president. It's kind of the Chris Christie choice.
Yeah. Well, Jack Warden has, that's more of a regular guy president. It's more of a Bill Pullman type.
Bill Pullman. Very interesting.
Independence Day.
How'd you like Bill Pullman as president?
Well, I think everyone liked Bill Pullman as president because we had a president finally who could actually get into a fighter plane and go kill aliens.
George Bush was in a fighter pilot suit. He got out of a plane. He flew and landed on the deck of an aircraft carrier.
Yes. At least he was a passenger.
Some people thought he was actually acting out the role of Bill Pullman's role in Independence Day.
As a piece of stage management, that was something. That was Pullman-esque.
All right. Let's run through three in rapid succession. We'll play all three of them in a row. I think you guys can do that. So here's Morgan Freeman as president, Tom Beck in Deep Impact, and then we're going to hear Harris. No, we'll hear Morgan Freeman first. Well, here's what Morgan Freeman. Well, none of them are there. All right, whatever. We had some clips. They disappeared.
Wow.
You know why? Probably Secret Service stuff.
Yeah.
What? Oh, now you have Day-Lewis, though? All right, we'll go back in time. We'll hear some Daniel Day-Lewis. Here's Daniel Day-Lewis as Lincoln.
We're stepped out upon the world stage now with the fate of human dignity in our hands. Blood's been spilled to afford us this moment. Now.
I do like his voice there. Is he giving a speech right there? Or is he talking to his friends?
I think he's talking around a table. But people at the time, I think, remarked on Lincoln's voice. Public speaking in an age without amplification, one was successful by having almost a horn-like voice, which would sound strange to us now, as indeed that sort of sounded strange when you hear it, pulled out of context like that. But that was how you made yourself heard, Lincoln apparently had that quality, somewhat high, somewhat almost like a horn-like voice that it doesn't sound that good when we hear it in a movie of the 21st century, but it's probably closer to what a Politico might have actually sounded like back then.
All right, so who were the great presidents portrayed in TV and movies, and why did they appeal to us? Or who were the ones that weren't so great as well, the ones that maybe deliberately were portrayed like Dr. Strangelove, or ones that were just not believable? 206-543-5869 is a number I'd like you to weigh in and share some of that with us. 1-800-289-5869. I want to take your calls. 206-543-5869. 1-800-289-5869. Email weekday at KUOW.org. And there's a discussion going on over at Facebook too. Weekday on KUOW. All right. So here's Bill Pullman. As you said, he was really the quintessential president for fighting wars and stuff.
In less than an hour, aircraft from here will join others from around the world. And you will be launching the largest aerial battle in the history of mankind.
Okay, so that was him standing up. I think he's in that fighter pilot suit. How many times have I seen that movie, right? Getting ready to take his troops up to the alien spaceship.
That's right.
Herman Cain, Bill Pullman. Herman Cain also talked about alien invasions.
I saw that. That's right. Well, that calls to mind, too, another president during an actual outer space alien invasion, and that was Jack Nicholson in Mars Attacks.
Oh, yes.
Who also did not do that well, if I'm remembering the movie correctly. I haven't seen it since it
came out. I believe he had his head cut off.
Something bad happened to him. But certainly the idea of Jack Nicholson as the U.S. president was pretty fun. The movie got by on quite a bit just with that. Casting.
Harrison Ford,
yes,
was President James Marshall in the movie Air Force One.
Only when our own national security was threatened did we act. People were being slaughtered for over a year. We issued economic sanctions and hid behind a rhetoric of diplomacy. How dare we? The dead remembered. Real peace. It's not just the absence of conflict, it's the presence of justice.
He seems a little subdued there.
I don't remember him talking that much in that movie.
No, there's a lot more action in that movie.
Yes, I remember him throwing fists around.
Yeah, well.
That was a two-fisted president in a plane.
Yeah.
Throwing guys out the back.
I could have seen Romney and Obama doing both of those things.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
All right, and then one more here just for a taste. Morgan Freeman as President Tom Beck. Another space president, Tom Beck, in Deep Impact.
We'd always thought the deadline for going public was the publication of the budget, since we've spent more money than we can hide. But the budget comes out in 2 weeks.
I don't suppose I could convince you to sit on this for 2 weeks.
He sounds, Morgan Freeman sounds presidential. Well, just the timbre of his voice.
It's an easy casting choice.
Yeah.
Like casting him as God, which he has done more than once. He does sound like the role, yeah.
All right, who were great presidents, and what do we learn from them, if anything at all? We have a couple other clips I want to get to before we're done here on this. But I was thinking of some – don't we have a TV series right now that has somebody as a president? I forget who it is. I think it's Bill – who is that person who's playing the president? Some NBC series, which I'm sure won't last more than another week or two. But Gina Davis was on TV. She played a president on television. We've had some women presidents finally.
Isn't Julia Louis-Dreyfus involved in?
Oh,
was
she
vice president?
She's vice president. Yeah. That's right.
I'll name a favorite TV president from the past, and that is William Devane, who played JFK in The Missiles of October, which made a big impression on me. I don't know how old I was, maybe 15 or something when it came on, and I was very interested in things like that, and it's about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And Devane was kind of an unknown actor at that point and was obviously cast because he certainly looked a bit and sounded quite a bit like John F. Kennedy. And that was a really memorable – I mean, maybe partly because he was a new sort of actor and he didn't drag along any other associations with him, but that was a really gripping teleplay of the 70s, and Devane was just great in it.
I was trying to remember who played the presidents in the more recent Cuban Missile Crisis movie.
Well, I think Bruce Greenwood was in the one with.
But was he president? Foster. Was he JFK?
Yeah,
in
I
that
think
one?
So.
It is Bill 13, Pullman 13 who's in the show 13 Days. That's right. He's in the show 1600 Penn. It is Bill Pullman.
Oh, right.
Revising his role.
Has that started already? I missed that.
Who knows if it's even still around? Bob says Kevin Kline and Dave best president.
Mm-hmm.
He was a regular guy president. Like
that's another
that.
One of those wish fulfillment, why couldn't an actual president be like this person sort of movies, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Also, Harry Morgan played Grant in a 1962 version of How the West Was Won.
Mm-hmm.
And then Rod Steiger played him in the 1992 movie Lincoln. And Senator Fred Thompson played Grant in a 2007 TV movie Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. Wow, look at who played Grant. Those are interesting choices.
I didn't see the Thompson one, but he's very well portrayed by Jared Harris in Spielberg's Lincoln. Doesn't have a lot of screen time, but Jared Harris really looks uncanny in the role.
By the way, Fred sent that. And I don't know, Fred is that was pretty good.
That Fred Thompson himself?
Yeah, he said that.
He'd like people to remember, understandably so.
Do you have any really least favorite presidential portrayals? Megan from Sammamish says her least favorite is Billy Bob Thornton in Love Actually.
Yes. although balanced by the idea that Hugh Grant might be the prime minister.
Yes, right.
That is, of the UK. That is good.
You know, the actor who, what's his name right now? He's doing the insurance ads. The actor who played the president on 24. I thought he was a very good president.
Right.
I'd be voting for him. Some people think they did. Voting for President Obama, right?
I don't know why I can't think of his name at the moment, but yeah, he was. He had the authority in the early going of 24.
Wow, there's so many people to choose from. Michael Douglas, an American president, certainly the sexiest, Peg says. And I believe that Bob agrees with that. Excellent performance. Maybe she also thought he was the sexiest. I don't. He also thought he was the sexiest. I don't know.
Not Donald Pleasence in Escape from New York. I find that hard to believe.
Donald Pleasence.
There's one of your not great presidents.
That's good. That's good. I like that.
I had to get the president out of Manhattan, which is in the future a penal colony.
We could just do all the SNL portrayals. And Chris, C. Johnson says, who could forget Chevy Chase as Gerald Ford?
Yeah.
That was less of a portrayal than pratfall.
Well, I think at some point Ford came to think that that might have cost him the election, just to be portrayed as a complete boob. Who can imagine?
Jeff Bridges was president in The
Yes.
Contender.
Yes.
Frank Langella was in Frost Nixon. He was Nixon.
Right. My favorite Nixon I'd like to put forward, it was Philip Baker Hall, the character actor, in a movie called Secret Honor. It was directed by Robert Altman.
Really?
Yes, it's an adaptation of a one-man show, and it's just Philip Baker Hall for 90 minutes, and he's not really trying to do an impersonation of Nixon, and yet he has captured something essential. And the movie gets into a little bit of a Fantasia sort of thing, but it's just a bravura performance. And Nixon, of course, has been played many times, but he really goes with it.
All right. Dennis Haysbert. Actor 24. All right, just two last quick clips of some other presidential portrayals. Tim Robbins as the president and Austin Powers, the spy who shagged me.
Dr. Evil, this is 1969. That amount of money doesn't even exist. That's like saying, I want a kajillion bajillion dollars.
Tim Robbins would make a good president.
He'd like to be president, I'll bet.
And Harry Shearer, he was President Schwarzenegger in the Simpsons movie.
I've narrowed your choices down to five unthinkable options. Each will cause untold misery.
I pick number three.
You don't even want to read them first?
I was elected to lead, not to read. Number three.
And Albert Brooks there. That was Albert Brooks too, right?
Yes. Strangely, there are two White House movies coming out in future months.
They are.
Almost on the same plot, actually.
Really?
Yeah. One of them is called White House Down. The other, I think, is called Olympus Has Fallen. So everything's down. In White House Down, Jamie Foxx is the president. Both involve the president getting either incapacitated or kidnapped within the White House, and people have to go in and save the day, all that kind of thing.
I bet Jamie Foxx saves himself.
Yeah, but he's capable.
Yeah.
I'd bet on him against the terrorists. There's also a movie coming out called The Butler, which is a story of someone who serves in the White House through a bunch of different administrations, and it's going to have portrayals of various presidents. For instance, John Cusack as Nixon. Just throw that one out there.
All right. That was fun. A little walk down memory lane. You have anything you're doing, or you want us to know anything else that's coming out before
I
go?
I will invite people to come to another session of Framing Pictures on Friday afternoon at the Northwest Film Forum at 5. A bunch of critics talking about the movies of the day and issues of the day and interesting things. And on Sunday, I'm going to be out at Bainbridge Island. Yeah, at the Bainbridge Island History Museum, I think is what it's called. Bainbridge Island Museum of Art is what I meant to say, because there's a one-man show about Orson Welles that will be performed there, and I've been invited to come and talk about Welles after the show with the actor and director and give a little context to that.
Orson Welles never played the president, did he?
That's a good question, but it certainly seems like he should have.
I think so.
At some point, I think he entertained the thought of maybe getting that job in the 1940s. He was very politically minded, wrote a lot of op-ed pieces, almost in the way that Reagan went about becoming president at first.
Really?
Being a spokesman, sure. Commentator, columnist, yeah.
Huh. All right. You're a font of information, sir.
Thank you, Steve.
Leave us to talk again. This is Weekday.
KUOW. It's 10:42.
KUOW and the University of Washington Simpson Center for the Humanities present the CAS Distinguished Lecture in the Humanities featuring Kathy Davidson on the future of higher education, Thursday, February 21st at University of Washington's Kane Hall. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
47 degrees and overcast in the University District this morning. Our forecast today calls for cloudy skies with a chance of rain. We'll have a high today of about 50 degrees. Tonight's going to be cloudy with some rain possible. We'll see a low around 46. For tomorrow, expect some rain in the morning, then a chance of some rain during the afternoon. We'll have a high of 48. And looking ahead to Friday, should be mostly cloudy with some areas of morning fog. Expect some afternoon sun breaks, though. We'll have a high of about 53 degrees.
Support for KUOW comes from guitarist Andre Ferriante, presenting Words of Love Valentine's Day concert at Benaroya Hall on February 14th, featuring his new CD, Beatles Masquerade, with guests Overton Berry, Steve Thorson, and flamenco dancer Stella Rossi. Details at andreferriante.com.
You don't always need a radio to hear KUOW. Listen anywhere, anytime with our free KUOW smartphone app. And you can hear us online at KUOW.org. I'm Rob Wood. Stay with us. We'll check news headlines coming up at 11:01 this morning here on 94.9 KUOW.
Now we're going to take a look at the economy as we do every Wednesday. Michael Parks is here, editor emeritus of Marple's Northwest Business Letter, resource about the economy and companies of the Pacific Northwest and Alaska. He also writes about business all the time, and you can find him at michaeljparks.com. Good to see you again, sir.
Good morning, Steve. Good to be here.
One thing I found fascinating in the president's State of the Union was when he talked about these manufacturing centers, these high-tech manufacturing centers he wants Congress to help him establish around the country. There's one already. Remember, I took that trip to Europe and doing stories on how Europe was dealing with the euro, but also how they were dealing with changing economies. And we went to a former textile mill in Lille, France, and the buildings were saved and gutted and remade from the inside into this amazing high-tech laboratory. It's just what the president's talking about. It's the model, I'm sure, and it's probably being done all over the world. But you could walk through this former textile mill, and you could get up onto the fifth, sixth floor, wherever we were, and the man who took us around pointed out, and he said, there's all the workers' housing, and it's still low-income housing. This is a poorer neighborhood, and our job is to get those people in here and train them and expose them to RFID technology, to telecommunication technology, to fiber optic technology, to app development, all those things. And the EU, the city government of Lille, and the provincial government were all putting a lot of money. And there was a lot of money put into that program.
And we know there's a need for that sort of thing because we have millions of jobs in the United States that are going unfilled because people lack the skills. I suppose the debate would be over whether this is better done in the public sector than the private sector. We have, I don't know if anybody has an accurate count of how many public sector job training transitioning programs we have. I think they have a mixed record. I don't know of many great successes, but certainly repurposing old industry for new industry is a good idea. My watching of the president's speech last night was interrupted by a phone call from my daughter, so I didn't pick up on that one.
It's an interesting thought. Yeah. And as you mentioned, I mean, there is this debate about the minimum wage.
Yes.
And the president talked about raising the federal minimum wage. States like ours have already.
We were ahead of the pack. Let me say a couple of things. First of all, income equality in this country is scandalous. And the idea that people who are working full-time should remain below the poverty level is a scandal. But the conservative response to the idea of raising the minimum wage is to point to, for example, parts of Europe where labor markets have become so inflexible that youth unemployment in Spain, for example, is 50%. And the more you add to the inflexibility of labor markets, and raising the minimum wage certainly adds to inflexibility, the more you reduce opportunities.
Of course, youth unemployment is high in Europe in part because of their own problems in the recession.
Sure,
right?
Absolutely.
But you're saying it's aggravated by this inflexibility.
Yeah. I don't know if there's a study as to whether youth unemployment in Washington is higher than it would be because our minimum wage is already in excess of the level that was proposed by the president.
I'm sure we could find conflicting studies. I mean, that's part of the problem, right?
Yeah.
These are questions about, I mean, what did somebody say as commentary? If you couldn't keep your business open by paying somebody at least what President Obama was proposing as minimum wage, maybe you shouldn't be in business. I don't know.
There is something to that. You know, we don't accommodate some businesses, although we're loosening up on others. For example, there are going to be lots of new job opportunities by November or December in an entirely new vice that has been approved by the voters of the state of Washington.
It will be very interesting to see how that affects wages in that industry, right?
Well, and employment opportunities, considering that standards and tests may preclude some people who indulge in that vice from lots of job opportunities, including positions in government, for example.
That's true.
Law enforcement, piloting, transportation, driving buses, all those sorts of things, if they find a certain chemical in your bloodstream.
I wonder how many people will be hired as marijuana testers by the state.
Well, we know that the Washington State Liquor Control Board is looking for people to staff its effort in this area.
Here's what the president did say, something about manufacturing. I want to circle back around to that because I want to ask you about Boeing and the like. But here is what the president said about manufacturing when he was giving his State of the Union.
So tonight I'm announcing the launch of three more of these manufacturing hubs where businesses will partner with the Department of Defense and Energy to turn regions left behind by globalization into global centers of high-tech jobs. And I ask this Congress to help create a network of 15 of these hubs and guarantee that the next revolution in manufacturing is made right here in America. We can get that done.
The reason I circle back around, of course, this idea of manufacturing back in America. He talks about Apple coming back.
Right.
Boeing is dealing with that question of manufacturing right now.
Absolutely. There's no question that the global outsourcing that Boeing implemented to build the 787, essentially abandoning the role of being an aircraft manufacturer and adopting the role of being a systems integrator and bringing in all these partners around the world where people put up capital but also did the, you know, the specs, did some of the testing. Didn't work out so well, did it? We're 3.5 years behind schedule. And now we have a product that's on the ground that is not earning revenue. Inventories are piling up because Boeing hasn't yet said whether it's going to stop production. And the program is hurting, and Boeing is going to be hurt financially because of it. I'm frankly a bit surprised that Boeing stock is trading about where it was on July 17 or 18 when the whole fleet was grounded. I would have thought, of course, you could say the stock market's been going up.
January, yes.
Boeing has been flat, so it's not been keeping pace. But there are clearly going to be large financial penalties as a result of the problems with the battery.
Yeah, you know, and it I mean, the battery is a great example of, you know, the technology moved a little bit ahead of what they can do to study it and to utilize it.
Sure.
I should say the use of it moved ahead of the technology.
Right.
And it's very interesting to see how they're going to solve that problem.
Yeah.
Because they need knowledge. They need lots of people who have the knowledge to test these
things. Yeah, my worry is that they're going to have to redesign the whole electrical system to perhaps accommodate nickel cadmium or some other technology. Now, there's a perverse bit of silver lining for Washington's economy if that happens. Clearly, employment in aerospace in Washington is higher than it would have been had the 787 outsourcing plan worked as intended. We have lots of people fixing and taking care of problems that were not anticipated, and that could happen on the 787 program if they have to redo the electrical system entirely.
Yeah. All right, you noticed something interesting that's happening here, and that's the outbreak of these currency wars.
Right.
I should call them currency wars yet, but they might be.
The people are worried about currency wars. Of course, we're in the fifth year in the United States of the low interest rate policy. The shorthand is NZERP.
Oh, really?
Yeah, near zero interest rate policy, literally uncharted territory. Now we have Japan, a new leader who's making a determined effort, telling the Bank of Japan to loosen up, weakening the yen, which will make Japan's exports more competitive, and essentially trying to reintroduce inflation into Japan, which has suffered for 20 years from deflation. And that has set off some concern around the world of essentially what would be competitive devaluations, or otherwise known as beggar thy neighbor monetary policy, where economies reduce the value of their currencies to make their exports more competitive. And, you know, we get into kind of a down the drain together situation.
Isn't that the argument that people make about what China's doing with its currency?
Well, yes, people argue that China has not allowed its currency to be as strong as it would be if its currency were free. So exactly right.
And now they're talking about the euro. There's some talk from the ECB, the head of the European Central Bank, maybe weaken
lower
the euro?
Interest rates or reduce interest rates. Of course, Mario Draghi said last summer, we will do whatever it takes, three magic words, which, you know, if you think about broad economic problems, one of the things that's kind of dropped off the radar screen is the idea that the euro is going to implode. One of my takes is that Angela Merkel has decided that the cost of leaving is greater than the cost of staying, which will involve subsidies essentially by German taxpayers to the southern part of
They seem to have accepted that across the north.
Yeah. We thought that Greece would be out by now. Greece is still in, and no talk of Greece being out, although there's no question that times are hard in Greece. You read about people not being able to pay their heating bills in the wintertime.
Well, you're talking about the two-speed world.
Sure.
What you mentioned.
Yeah. There's no question that the global economy is operating at two different speeds. And the IMF came out, I think, a week ago with a global economic outlook pointing out that the advanced economies in Q4 essentially were operating at zero growth, with emerging and developing economies operating in the neighborhood of 6 to 7%. The good news is that last year, about this time, the big concern was whether China could achieve a soft rather than a hard landing. And it's pretty clear that China has managed to achieve that soft landing, which is good news for the global economy, if you will.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
See, they're good at manipulating. I shouldn't say manipulating. of regulating and running their state-controlled economy.
But at the same time, they have tremendous political problems, which are growing as the Chinese middle class grows and as people have more access to the internet and more understanding of the freedoms that people enjoy in economies that are not command economies.
One last thing. We're talking to Michael J. Parks, who is editor emeritus of Marple's Northwest Business Letter. He's been a long time, what should I call it, commentator on the economy.
Economy watcher.
We were talking about the sequester, President Obama's call to Congress to do something about the way the economy is moving, because people are generally upset about the uncertainty of the sequester and what's happening in Washington. People are holding on to their cash.
Companies are holding on to their cash. Record amounts of cash on the balance sheets of major companies. Much of it, quote unquote, offshore. But as we read in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago, offshore accounts that are invested in American dollars, one way or the other. I guess the good news is that consumers seem to be in a better mood than companies are. And I think companies remain in a sour mood because of uncertainty about taxes, uncertainty about regulation, uncertainty about health care, which does not come into full effect until next year.
Well, no uncertainty about me. Grateful for you being here.
There's always a pleasure, Steve. I always enjoy it.
Thank you for being here. Rob Woods, our engineer today. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Magano, Amin Al-Sadi, Andy Hurst. Daniel Anthony Goodwin is our intern. By the way, all that talk about the economy and outsourcing and what the future holds. Al Gore is our guest tomorrow. We're going to have him on for 40 minutes. His book is thick. There's a lot there. It's very, very provocative. Al Gore's The Future. We're going to talk to him tomorrow. Take your calls. If you have questions for him, do join us as well. That's tomorrow on Weekday. Have a good day. We'll be right back.
This is KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. We're online at KUOW.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Franz Chocolates, celebrating 30 years of handcrafting confections in Seattle, now featuring new Valentine's gift assortments. At Franz Downtown at First and Union, in University Village, on Old Main Street in Bellevue, and online at franzchocolates.com.
47 degrees and overcast in Seattle's University District this morning. Our forecast today calls for cloudy skies with a chance of rain. We'll see a high later on this afternoon around 50 degrees. It's going to be cloudy with rain possible tonight. We'll have an overnight low of about 46. Tomorrow, expect some rain in the morning. It'll be cloudy with a chance of rain during the afternoon. We'll see a high of about 48. And Friday calls for mostly cloudy skies with some areas of morning fog. Some afternoon sun breaks, though. Expect a high near 53 degrees.
Dave Boone has been a joke writer for the Academy Awards.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.